I'm Brian McCreath from WCRB. I'm here with Johannes Moser, who is back in Boston for the second time, this time playing the Dvorak Concerto. Johannes, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to talk with me today.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. Thank you.
So I'm always curious to know, when soloists appear with concertos, especially the really well-known concertos, what was your first memory of encountering the Dvorak Concerto, either in a recording or a performance anywhere?
Oh, I have a very strong memory of this. I started cello when I was 8 years old, and when I turned 9, I got tickets to see the Dvorak Concerto with Heinrich Schiff in Munich. And I don't remember much of the performance, but I remember a relatively small person entering the stage furiously with a red head. And then as soon as he started playing, he turned purple. And that, as a 9-year old, really was engraved in my brain. I'm sure the music was glorious, as I'm really a fan of his playing. But certainly that memory stuck very, very much to me.
Yeah. And, you know, as a person just starting out on the instrument, it must have had a huge impact. But that sort of points to the fact that the Dvorak is one of the most played of cello concertos for very good reasons. You just recorded it about a year ago. What did you do to sort of, I can't imagine there's not baggage that comes with you along the way with Dvorak at any time. What did you do to separate from that to really make the recording you wanted to make?
Well, baggage, I think, is really the word that is hitting it on the head, because there are so many fantastic recordings out there, recordings that I grew up with. I mean, just to name a few, Rostropovich, Yo-Yo Ma, Jacqueline Dupré, all these recordings that I had in my, you know, I was growing up with them. And so I thought, you know, if I want to make another recording, I need to distance myself from these recordings and I need to find my own voice. And so I did a couple of things. I stopped listening to recordings of that piece, basically 1.5 years before, to sort of clean my system. And I really revisited the score, not only like, you know, throwing away my old parts and buying new ones and really making a new edition of myself, but I also bought the facsimile of the autograph of the piece. And reading through Dvorak's handwriting was really a key for me, because I saw how much struggle it was for Dvorak to put this piece on paper. You see passages being crossed out, you see passages being replaced, you even see comments, you know, after a passage composed on October 19, and by the way, I had borscht for lunch, and then there was a huge thunderstorm in the evening. I mean, you find really real life information in this score, you know, and suddenly this divine masterpiece gets a touch of humanity. And I think that was something that took sort of I still have huge respect for this piece, but it took a little bit the angst away of approaching this piece and making a statement on recording.
And do you feel like this piece sort of has more to gain from that sort of experience, a sort of almost as close as you can get to a firsthand contact with a composer who's been dead for a long time? Do you think this piece has more to gain than maybe some other pieces of music that you would play?
That is hard to say. I mean, I do the same thing with the Elgar Concerto, by the way. Okay. But Elgar's writing is pristine. Yeah, just like Richard Strauss or Hindemith. Or Mozart, for that matter. I mean, these were people that were able to channel the music beforehand and just write something, you know, perfectly crafted in their mind. Whereas the key to Dvorak is much more craftsmanship, in the sense of working on it as we go through it. So I think that seeing that firsthand is really an eye-opener.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The other thing about Dvorak, I've only been able to visit Prague once, and yet I found it completely enrapturing and felt like there was a resonance with the music that very few locations have with the music associated with them. You've been to Prague to record the concerto. Had you been there before, and did those surroundings sort of inform you even further as you performed it?
You know, it was actually my first visit to that city, not even as a tourist, and which is really, you know, shameful, because obviously I lived in Berlin for 15 years, and really it is just a 3-4 hour train ride to go to Prague. So, you know, everything in Europe is so close. But it really was my first time going to that city, and it was a little bit of a shock, you know, to see that beauty, to see how well preserved everything is, you know, how People are proud of their heritage there. But seeing Prague is only one side of the medal. I think what really informed me the most was to work with Czech musicians and to just not even talking about the music so much, but really per osmosis, you get so much of their style, of their understanding, and how they just breathe and live their music, you know. I think that is something to be said for Czech musicians, is that they are incredibly proud of their musical heritage, you know, and rightfully so, because some of the most glorious music comes from that country.
As we're hearing in this concert, absolutely. For sure. Yeah, the whole concert. And it's too bad that Jiří Bělohlávek couldn't be here. Is he someone that you had worked with before?
I have not, actually. It's a funny story, because I auditioned for Bělohlávek about 15 years ago. And I did a lot of conductors auditions, and he was one of the first ones. And he was sitting there in the Leipzig Gewandhaus together with a skinny kid that was accompanying him. And it turns out that kid was actually Jakub Ruscha, with whom I would then, you know, 14 years later, record the Dvořák Concerto. Yeah. So we already made contact early on. This would have been my first musical encounter with Bělohlávek. And as sad I am that we are not going to share the podium after all this time, I am absolutely thrilled that Ludovic Morlot has agreed to do this concert. We had the first rehearsal today, and he is absolutely amazing in the way that he can shape the orchestra in this really truly symphonic piece. You need somebody with symphonic understanding, and that is what he has.
Yeah, and he's so well loved around here that the relationship is built in because of his history with the BSO. Your own history, you are the child of parents who are musicians. You started very early, as you mentioned, 8 years old, you started the cello. Was it therefore sort of just, did you always have the feeling that this is the path you would be taking, or was there a moment when you decided, I'm now going to make a commitment to music as what my calling is going to be for the foreseeable future, at least?
Right. Well, you know, there was a very strong will to become an astronaut when I was 9 years old. So, I mean, I had
really?
To overcome to overcome that period first.
That's fantastic.
And then it was private detective, I think. So, you know, once I overcame the will to do these jobs, I thought music would be my next option. You're absolutely right. Coming from a musician's family does sort of put a stamp on your future a little bit. So I think what my parents were able to show me is how to live a musician's life and still have a normal life at the same time. Because I think, you know, so much of the idea of the traveling virtuoso of the 1800s, you know, with long hair like Paganini and Liszt, you know, not paying tribute to any sort of schedule and just being totally free-spirited, that is not a reality in musician's life. I mean, you need to be more like a sports person. You need to be incredibly rigid about, you know, about food, about sleep, because the travel is just so intense. So my parents were able to show me that very very, very clearly. But I mean, you know, it's not only my parents that started that musical tradition. I mean, my aunt Edda Moser, you know, was a very, very known soprano. My grandfather worked together with Richard Strauss, and my great grandfather worked together with Josef Joachim and Johannes Brahms on, you know, creating together with Josef Joachim, he created a violin school, and he also met Brahms a couple of times. So my family has been involved over you know, a long period of time with sort of the German music scene, and I mean, hey, no pressure, right?
No, it's
it's a weird heritage to start working out in, but at some point, of course, you just realize, hey, everybody for himself, and you just have to really make your own way, and this is what I'm trying to do.
Okay, so that makes my next question maybe even a little bit more fun to think about. So this long history of musicians in your family, a real legacy of encounters with the greatest musicians of the German heritage. Your generation, though, is dealing with a completely different world. What did you decide or what have you come to know that you need to do differently as a musician from those previous generations to be able to communicate what you want to communicate or to carve your way through this world? What do you have to do differently?
So I think what is both amazing and also really challenging about my job is that every place is different musically, you know, and with our sort of, you know, jet set possibilities in travel, I encounter a different sound world literally every week. I mean, January has been a little bit crazy. I mean, I started out in London with Recital, and then I went to Chicago with the Chicago Symphony, which, of course, has a completely different sound than the following week, which was Paris, you know, much more fragile sound, much more colors. And then coming here to the Boston Symphony, again, another amazing different sound world. And so I think it is hugely important to really open your ears every week and have a fresh approach to the repertoire that you're playing. Because if you play, you know, I mean, I play Dvorak very much. And if I play it the same everywhere I go to, it will not pay tribute to where I'm actually playing, you know? So then it becomes almost generic, you know, in a way. And so I need to constantly reinvent my views with what I hear. So this is an incredibly, you know, demanding process, but it's also very, very exciting to be able to do that. And with the possibilities of fast travel, you need to be able to sleep when you have those 7 hours and not be haunted by sleeplessness and all those kind of things. I mean, that is also a big challenge. And I'm not necessarily sure if just because we have the possibility of all this travel, we really need to take advantage of it in the way that we do. You know, also maybe being a little bit more conscious about the environment and all that. But it's just like that in this way, and we'll see how that develops.
Yeah, well, and I've always wondered how much various soloists are affected in what they're playing by the orchestra that's there with them. And you're saying that's actually a really significant factor for you as you play the Dvorak with different orchestras.
Absolutely. And I think to believe that playing as a soloist is a one-way street is an absolute illusion. I think the times of the autistic soloist just doing her or his thing on stage and not caring about the world and the surroundings, those times are over. That also goes for conductors, of course. I mean, I think when the Berlin Philharmonic hired Abado and they were on first name terms, you know, after dealing with Karajan in sort of a godlike fashion, and then also you know, around the world having young music directors that meet the musicians really on the same level, on the same playing field, I think that demands also for soloists to do exactly the same thing. So we are really collaborators, you know, as Julius Caesar said, primus inter pares. So that means like the first one under equals, you know, and the with the accent on equals, I think. Yeah.
Okay, so you bring up Julius Caesar, and I understand that there's there's a lot of other ways you spend your time. What is the most powerful non-musical informant or inspiration for your work as a musician? Does anything cross over from the other things you do to help you with your particular approach to music?
I think it starts with making breakfast and you know, watching the news, as gruesome and terrible as it is right now, to, you know, going to a museum or reading a book. I mean, right now I'm reading a fantastic book by Max Frisch, and just to constantly sort of keep the brain entertained, shall we say. But I think there is no way of saying, okay, now I'm going to the museum in order to enhance my performance of the Haydn concerto. I think if you put a purpose to the non-musical activities, you really destroy that purpose, you know, and you really destroy also the pure pleasure of art consumption, you know. And really, sometimes I feel a physical need to go and see a good exhibition of contemporary art, and then it really nourishes me in a great way. But I would never say, hey, today I really enhanced my understanding of Lutoslavsky because I saw some Kandinsky, you know. So and I think that's a wonderful thing of the brain and the soul for that matter. Is that you don't have to make it your purpose in order to enhance your personality or your views. It goes automatically if you're just open and you are allowing influences to affect you.
Johannes Moser, it's great to have you back in Boston. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk with me today.
Thank you so much.